today, as always, I think we're going to start off with your presentation, Schmidt. I believe it's on Dönitz this week. Admiral Dönitz, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Karl Dönitz, the last German head of state, the last legal German head of state, as now we have occupied Germany and not proper Germany. So, yeah, Karl Dönitz, he was born in 1891 in Grünau near Berlin. At the age of 18, he joined the Imperial German Navy. He went through infantry, artillery, and torpedo training and graduated from officer school. At the beginning of the First World War, he was serving on a small cruiser, the SMS Breslau, which was sold to the Ottoman Empire, which was at that time allied with Germany. The Breslau was then involved in battles against Russian naval forces in the Black Sea. He earned himself the Iron Cross Second Class and also received Ottoman decorations for his achievements there. In 1916, he volunteered for service on submarines. After the necessary training, he served on several U-boats and earned himself the Iron Cross First Class this time. And in September of 1918, he was granted command of one. That U-boat was sunk in the Mediterranean by British naval units, however, but most of the crews survived and were taken prisoners. After the war had ended and Dönitz had been released from captivity, he went back to Germany and started to develop theories and tactics. Theories on tactics and strategies for submarine warfare. In the interwar years, he worked his way up in the German Navy. He commanded torpedo boats, a corvette, a frigate, and then in 1934, as captain of the cruiser Emden, he spent several months in Southeast Asia. After returning, General Admiral Raeder tasked him with the creation of the submarine fleet. This had become possible because Adolf Hitler had freed Germany from the chains of the Treaty of Versailles in the same year. In 1939, he was appointed Commodore. 1 month after the beginning of the Second World War, he was promoted to Rear Admiral and served as Befehlshaber der Unterseeboote, or Commander of the Submarines. He immediately began to put the theories he had developed into practice. One of these was the doctrine to have one-third of the submarines in the combat zones, one-third moving either from the combat zones to safe harbors, or the other way around, and one-third undergoing maintenance, repairs, refueling, etc. Another one that he came up with was what he called the Rudeltaktik, which called for a submarine that had spotted an enemy convoy to radio the position and course of that target to the headquarters via the Enigma cipher machine without attacking. It was to wait until more submarines had joined and then to attack together in a pack, as it were. The first time this tactic was used was on the 5th of October 1940, and it resulted in devastating losses for the Allies. Five German U-boats under the command of Otto Kretschmer, also known as Silent Otto, the most successful submarine commander of all times, attacked an Allied convoy consisting of 35 ships, and 20 of these were sunk in one night, causing the loss of 80,000 tons of supplies to the Allies. He also recommended that the submarines attack on the surface because of better accuracy and they are faster to outrun a convoy or to catch up with it. In March of 1942, Dönitz was promoted and appointed to the rank of admiral. And in early 1943, he succeeded Erich Raeder as Grand Admiral. There's a long list of his decorations and awards, both from the First and the Second World War, but to mention only a few. The Knight's Cross to the Iron Cross with oak leaves, a special version of the U-boat war badge with diamonds, made exclusively for him. He was the only one to ever wear it. The Military Order of Savoy, given to him by Italy. The Military Order of Michael the Brave, from Romania. And towards the end of the war, on the 21st of January 1945, Dönitz launched Operation Hannibal, which had the aim of evacuating as many Germans as possible from the advancing, raping and murdering Bolsheviks. Using all available war, passenger and transport ships, they managed to save almost 2 million men, women and children. This was the largest evacuation operation in history. The Soviets torpedoed many of these refugee ships, causing tens of thousands to die. One of these ships was the Wilhelm Gustloff. Over 9,000 Germans perished. Over 5,000 of these children and thousands of women, elderly and wounded. This was the largest catastrophe at sea in recorded history. Everybody knows about the Titanic, but how many have ever even heard of the Wilhelm Gustloff? After he had done as much as possible to save as many Germans as possible, Dönitz on the 7th of May authorized Alfred Jodl, the chief of staff of the OKW, to sign the surrender documents, which specified that all German military forces had to cease operations at 11 p.m. on the 8th of May. The Allies had threatened to resume the terror bombing of German cities otherwise. Dönitz continued to act as the legitimate head of the German Reich until, in violation of international law, he and other members of the government were arrested by British soldiers. This meant the de facto dissolution of the last legitimate German government. And the last two times you have heard how he became head of state after Adolf Hitler's death. So after the war, they imprisoned Dönitz for 10 years in the Spandau prison in Berlin. He was accused of, again, we know the story of war crimes, but they had no actual evidence of that, but they still condemned him to 10 years in prison. He lived a quiet life until his death after he was released from prison. He died at the age of 89 in the year 1980. He was buried at the Waldfriedhof Cemetery in Aumühle, where he had lived. The administration of occupied Western Germany forbade that he could be buried with military honors. Soldiers were not allowed to wear uniforms to the funeral. In spite of this, a number of German naval officers disobeyed this order and were joined by members of the Royal Navy in full dress uniform. Over 5,000 people attended, among them over 100 Knight's Cross holders, including Hans-Ulrich Rudel. Yes, that was it, my biography of Dönitz.
Let's say, when you say there that the members of the Royal Navy went to his funeral, is that the British Royal Navy?
Yes, it is. That's how it is reported.
That's good. That's promising to see.
He actually received quite a lot of letters of admiration from Allied naval soldiers and officers.
Well, I bet he did with all those medals that he'd won, and being the submarine commander and having a medal just made up especially for himself. What was did you know what the Romanian one was for? Why the Romanians were giving him a medal?
No, I think this just had to do with the war effort in general. I remember quite a few Germans receiving foreign decorations, but I don't know if this was for a specific sea battle or anything like that. As Romania is landlocked, I don't think they had much to do with naval warfare in the Second World War.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
But yeah.
That's what I was thinking. They must have been really grateful for something. And where was it that they were rescuing the German refugees from? Where was it they were rescuing them from and taking them to?
Well, that was because Eastern Prussia was already almost completely blocked by the Red Army, and they had to evacuate as many as they could by sea then. That's why they were using all these transport and warships and passenger ships, everything they could get hold of. And the Wilhelm Gustloff, the passenger ship that was sunk by a Soviet submarine, was actually used to be a Kraft durch Freude ship. It was used to enable holidays for the average German worker, where they would sail to Italy, for example, to go on holiday with a greatly subsidized fare for low-income workers.
Yeah, so that the workers could travel and see a bit of the world. They actually prevented any of those ships from docking in Britain because they didn't want the British workers to see how well-treated the German workers were. See what a success the National Socialist government was over there and how well they treated their workers. And that's, you would think that that would be held up as a war crime. You know, shooting a defenseless ship that's just taking refugees. I mean, we're told we're not allowed to shoot these. We're not allowed to shoot these ships full of invaders coming over from Africa. We've got to go out there and rescue them. Yet when it's Germans that are on board a ship, hundreds of them, thousands of them, as you say, all right, it's perfectly fine to shoot them and we'll just forget about that. You know, that's a really, you know, down and dirty thing to do, isn't it? Just shoot a defenseless ship full of refugees. I had heard of the Wilhelm Gustloff, but I didn't know that many details about it. I didn't know that Donitz was involved with that. I thought at the time he was sort of taking over from Adolf Hitler. I didn't realize he was personally involved in that. Dennis, have you got anything you'd like to say about that presentation from Schmidt there?
Yeah, well, I knew, obviously, about the sinking. I mean, it really surprised me, like, because, you know, I mean, the Russians, or the Soviets, rather, didn't care much about any Geneva Convention. And Donitz was a highly honourable person, who obviously even some of the British knew. But he got treated badly, like I think I mentioned before, at the end of the war, when they come to the meeting, they refused to shake hands with him and made it plainly obvious that he wasn't just a surrendering officer, he was a prisoner of war and will be treated as such, which is totally opposite of how the Germans treated the French, if you remember, on the train coach. They give them all the respect required to an enemy, defeated enemy. Just a totally different world to how the Allies treated the Germans.
They were given full honours, weren't they? They were given full honours, the French were. I just got somebody in the chat room who was saying Romania has beaches on the Black Sea. So maybe there was some naval warfare in the Black Sea. And that might have been the reasoning for that medal. I was just thinking there, they accused him of war crimes, but nothing in specific then. Just war crimes. You were a Nazi, so we'll charge you with war crimes. They couldn't actually think of anything that he actually did.
They did call it unrestricted naval warfare because they attacked transport ships, but the Allies did the same. So there's no real logical or compelling reason for why he should be on trial for anything. And as I said, a lot of British and, in fact, Allied Navy people expressed their admiration for Dönitz and for the way he conducted the war from his side, from the naval perspective.
He was in the same prison as Rudolf Hess, somebody else that was just imprisoned for no reason, imprisoned for the whole of his life. I mean, Rudolf Hess was just on a peace mission, trying to bring a peace about with offers of peace. To put someone in prison who's on a peace mission and keep him locked up for the rest of his life, you would think that Amnesty International would get involved in that, that they would be saying, look at this injustice. This man died in prison after going on a peace mission. But no, nothing about that. There was a memorial put up for Rudolf Hess and the left went and smashed it to pieces. They desecrated it. And the police have done nothing about it since. In fact, there was an ITV film crew that went there along with the vandals to film them desecrating the war memorial. And nothing's been done about it. They'd never been charged with desecrating a war memorial. And yet this honourable man, really honourable man, risks his life to parachute in behind enemy lines with an offer of peace to try and stop the war. And look at what they did to him. It's disgusting. You know, and he was kept in solitary confinement as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was kept in solitary confinement. And then a week or so before his expected release, after so long in prison and such an old age, they said he committed suicide, which is ridiculous because, I mean, he's going to meet his family shortly, you know.
I've read a bit about the death of Hess, and it seems absolutely clear that he was murdered. I don't remember the details right now, but it had something to do with the strangulation. It doesn't seem possible that he could have done it himself, aside from all the other reasons. Why should he do that when he was all these decades in prison and he was about to be released? And I think from what I remember, it was the Soviets that didn't mind his release anymore, at least one of the Allied superpowers, it were. And I think, must have been really afraid what he could say about what he experienced at the time in Germany.
Well, it would have to be, wouldn't it?
So one of the main reasons for the solitary confinement and then, yeah, not releasing him.
And what other reason could there be? I mean, the guy was there trying to bring about a peace. You would think that they would keep him as a prisoner of war until the end of the war and then release him. What possible legal standing could they have had? And that's a real opium.
For years, really. I think the whole prison was empty. It wasn't just a cell, it was the whole prison. He was the only one in there, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Towards the end, he was the only one, yeah.
I mean, that's a real open flouting of the law, isn't it? I mean, that's just totally breaking the law. And, you know, I mean, there can't be any legal standing for that whatsoever. Just an open flouting of international law, and nobody publicizes it. Nobody talks about it. I mean, that should be proof enough to anyone that's not on our side that, you know, there is something iffy with the war, if you tell them about that. And with Amnesty International and all these other groups, you know, why haven't they made a fuss about it?
Amnesty International actually is funded by one of the Rockefeller foundations. So there you go.
Well, yeah, we know that. We know Amnesty International is more like Amnesia International. But, you know, the leftists, the average person thinks that Amnesty International are a good group of people that stand up for political prisoners of conscience. Yeah, you know, there you go. There you've got somebody who tried to stop a war, the World War, risked his life to do that, and his reward was to be in prison for the rest of his life. So it's obvious that he knew something that they couldn't risk getting out at all. Solitary confinement for the rest of his life. That's shocking. And after that, then, so when they arrested Donets, and then they just put in an occupational government, didn't they? They got rid of all the leading people and put in their own as an occupational government, occupying the area, and it's been the same ever since, hasn't it?
Correct.
Yes, they don't even have a proper constitution. What they have is the Grundgesetz, which was forced upon them by the Allies. And ever since then, there has been no German constitution written, no post-war German constitution.
I covered that in the documentary. There's that document, but there was one written by an East German officer. He revealed that there's another one signed previous to that behind closed doors, which gave the rights to the West, to all publishers and all media outlets right up to the end of the century.
The right to make the laws and tell them, you know, what they're supposed to be doing. This is why Merkel is allied against the German people, is because she's not of the German people. She's working for the UN. She's working for a group of people that were prosecuting a war against Germany and that never stopped prosecuting that war. It never came to an end. It's like Russia with Japan. Russia is still fighting against Japan on paper. It was on the news the other day that Putin was going over there to meet the Japanese president, but the war had never actually ended and Russia is still at war with Japan. Of course, they'll never tell you that the Allies and Britain and France are all still at war with Germany. In fact, France had come to a peace agreement with Germany. So it was terrorists that were fighting against Germany from France because there was an armistice. We've had an armistice in Ireland, yet we don't call the terrorists over there. We don't call them freedom fighters. You know, we don't call them the Irish resistance like the French resistance, like we do romanticize the French terrorists after they'd come to a peace agreement with Germany. All these things that we're told about war, these agreements and armistices and surrenderings, all of that went out the window in the Second World War. All of it.
Correct.